welcome to Book Talk. I'm Danny Scott, your host for a discussion of Taye Selassie's eagerly anticipated debut, Ghana Must Go. Joining me in the Scottish Book Trust studios to objectively peer through the clouds of hype is Ali Bowden, head of Edinburgh City of Literature, and Will Mackey, our very own writer development manager. Self-proclaimed novelist, screenwriter, photographer and designer, Taye Selassie rose to prominence with a viral article in which she gave birth to the term Afropolitan to describe a new generation of intelligent, worldly, ambitious Africans that went viral. Her subsequent Granta-published short story, The Sex Lives of African Girls, gained her awards, wide praise and comparisons to her mentor and friend, Toni Morrison. In her lyrical first novel, Selassie tells a cross-continental family saga of the size. Like Selassie, they are West African immigrants of Ghanaian and Nigerian descent trying to build a new, successful life on the western fringes of Boston. Surgeon father Kweku and beautiful mother Folo Shadi create and are raising four attractive, intelligent children when Kweku is unjustly dismissed, loses his way, and leaves Folo to raise the children penniless and alone. Years later, Kweku's premature death in his native Ghana brings together the fractured family for a journey to Africa for his funeral. So, Ali, where do you stand? Is Taye Selassie's first novel a once-in-a-generation debut or benefiting from some fairly powerful marketing?
That's an interesting question because I think it's a really good book and I think the hype, marketing, whatever else is a little bit distracting in the way perhaps that, you know, the focus is on the author rather than the book because the author is somewhat distracting. But it's a good book, that's the bottom line. It must have been tempting for the publishers to hype this because it has some beautiful earmarks that I can see a marketing department leaping on. I mean, the author is beautiful and stunning and eloquent and intelligent and, you know, it must be a dream on the PR front. The connection with Toni Morrison, the endorsement from Salman Rushdie, the 20 Granta, et cetera, you know, clearly this has a lot of potential. So I think it merits enthusiastic marketing.
Yeah, she is an exceptionally talented debut writer. The sort of reservation that I have is that in 20 years' time, when she's writing her third or fourth novel, she's no longer a debut writer, and there's no longer that kind of marketability. The writing potentially is going to have developed then, be at a different level. And there are a lot of writers who have been heavily hyped in the early stages of their careers, who are mid-career in a difficult place.
I read in a New York Times review, they felt the publisher in eagerness to get this amazing young writer out there, they perhaps rushed it into print without one last edit. Would you agree?
I'd say no, actually. I think it is strikingly poetic and lyrical. It's not at all verbose or overly wordy. It doesn't strike you as a book that has been rushed in its production or in its writing, in fact. I think one of its striking qualities about the language is that it has a terseness to it at times where just a few words capture an emotion very perfectly on the page. And I think that's the sign of a good writer. And it's certainly not the sign of bad editing. If this book were twice the length, I'd be saying, okay, you know, come back here with a red pen. But no, I think the writing style is impressive, actually.
Yeah, I think that when you're assessing a writer's style, it's a very sort of intangible thing to look at. But if you get a sense of a uniqueness, it's sort of the equivalent of a fingerprint in words. That's the writer's style. It's totally something totally unique. It's not overly lavish writing. It actually is quite concise in places. It's experimental. But I think it's a very careful, controlled style as well. A way of telling a story that a story hasn't really been told. I think it's a very interesting book in that sense.
It's also very well structured and very carefully structured.
Care to expand?
Well, it's in three parts, going, gone, go. In each of those sections, it addresses different aspects of the family and different aspects of the characters and their relationships. And as you progress through the book, you slowly unravel what's been happening behind the scenes. So you find out some of the backstory, but also then you expand on the characters and what they've been doing within that. So it's very, I think, intelligently and cleverly constructed.
The first section, for example, is very carefully structured when, you know, Kweku is kind of walking out through his house and out into the garden and he's going to die. And it's this very tiny period of time that's stretched out throughout that whole section, interleaving that with telling the stories from the other points of view of his family members, of his wife and where they are. That does speak to me of extremely careful construction and careful editing. everything that she does with time throughout the book, with time and place, she chops up the time, the chronology.
Yes, you sweep back and forward, don't you?
You do, completely.
And then back again, and then forwards again, and then sideways again.
It really does kind of go everywhere. And also with place, that one minute you're in this dormitory room at Yale, and the next you're in a mansion house in Lagos.
Quite delicately done, I think.
It is, yeah. When you read it, it doesn't drift at all. It works. It makes sense in the context of the novel.
I guess I can sympathise with the New York Times critics' ideas, because when I read the first half of this novel, I was really into it, and I thought this writing is just like fresh air in your face, sea salt on your nose. It's just beautiful. By the middle of the novel, I thought, okay, story's going to start soon. And by the third part of the novel, I was in that frame of mind where you go to an art gallery and you really take in the first few paintings. And then after about an hour, perhaps, you've reached a limit of the amount of beauty and wonderful writing that you can take in, and it begins to get too full. So I was getting to the point where characters were entering a room and about to say something, and we went on a 2 or 3 page backwards, forward, sideways exposition of their character, and I thought, oh my god, I don't know. From what I've read online, a few people have had that reaction, whereas other people have really engaged with this beautiful writing, because there's no doubt that this is beautiful writing.
I'd say it's on the high end of the literary market, actually. And I think when someone was asking me about it, I said, you know, well, it's essentially a family saga, a family drama. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I'd said that, I stopped, because I thought, actually, hang on a minute, that's going to make you think that it's quite rapid in its character development and there will be a good deal of plot movement. And I was thinking, that isn't the case with this. Your portrait analogy is a very good one, because it is actually something that you observe quite carefully. And this is back to this idea of delicacy. So it is a little bit different from, I think, your standard family saga.
Yeah, it's not really a linear narrative at all. If anything, it's sort of circular.
But I think the frustration you feel, I actually think that's quite a clever thing. I didn't feel that, but I think in a way it's conveying the unspoken quality of the story. So much of the story isn't told to you. You have to work it out between the characters, and so much of their story isn't spoken between each character.
And she'll occasionally hint at something that's happened. So you know,
yes,
early on between the twins, Taiwo,
something has occurred,
and Kehinde,
yeah,
something has occurred.
Yes.
And you read back. I had to read back a couple of times to think, what has occurred? Did I miss that? Was I drifting off somewhere?
But you're experiencing it as a family member, and that family would have experienced it so much unspoken.
I think that's interesting, yeah, because a lot of it, the action is taking place internally. There are external things happening, and it's much of it is sort of set during fairly turbulent times politically as well. It's, you know, such as relating to the title, Ghana Must Go, the period in the early 80s where people from Ghana were expelled from Nigeria. And that's obviously an essential part of the book, but it's not present particularly prominently, because everything is happening amongst the family. And then even more so than that, it's happening within every single character. So rather than, I suppose, writing widely, broadly, she's writing deeply, and everything is looking inward.
Internalized, and, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Although it's acknowledged that there are things happening, and, you know, there's mention of the Biafra conflict in there as well. But I think also that's fairly valid, because when great historical cultural events happen, people do still focus, I think, very much upon their immediate lives, upon their families particularly. And themselves, people do arguably still look very inwardly.
It's an interesting point, because I would say that's a weakness of the book.
That you don't get the historical context.
Mm, especially with a title like Ghana Must Go, which is so loaded. I mean, that's a culturally potent phrase.
Loaded in two ways. I think Ghana Must Go is the political movement, isn't it? When Ghanaians were expelled from Nigeria, but it's also the name for a bag.
Which again is mentioned in the book. But I'd felt that pretty much all the context in that sense, that exterior cultural and political landscape was not exactly ignored. But it was just held very, very, very much.
It's a backdrop.
It's
a backdrop.
It is, exactly.
Which is very different from someone like Adichie, who's running, Half a Yellow Sun. That's a very different approach to engaging with a political environment rather than backdrop. But this may, and in my head, I had put it down to the fact that it's a debut novel. And when you read a debut novelist, you make a whole load of assumptions. I'm thinking, well, this must be drawing on her personal experience. It's a very personal novel.
Yeah, and I also interpret it partly through the characters as well, who are relatively...
Very privileged.
Yeah, extremely privileged. Exceptionally successful and well-educated. They're quite removed from, particularly the four children, they're removed from their African heritage. But they also feel displaced in America as well. So they are, as a family anyway, in between these times that are happening around them, and also in quite a literal way, they're flying back and forth while things are going on.
I think the focus has been on the characters rather than on the environment, the setting, the backdrop, the politics, the wider cultural context.
That's right. And you're inside taxi cabs a lot, and you know, a long passage inside a bathroom, but very small spaces.
You're inside the character's head a lot of time as they gaze at their navel, one could say it as well. If one wanted to be harsh, it is on the high end of the literary scale. And I guess I'd perhaps, if I'd been honest, I'd out myself as being on the middle end of the literary scale. So I do like a bit of story. Is there enough story in here for the average? If someone, we're coming up for holiday season, is someone looking for a book to read on their holiday?
No. Step away.
Step away from Ghana Must Go.
I'm saying probably this isn't a pop it out your bag, I'm sitting in a cafe glancing through a book type of book. I think it's the kind of book that actually, because of the structure, it sweeps around and moves around, you need to pay attention. And the language, the style is so crafted, so poetic, it actually puts a demand on you.
What The Independent described as mostly in the 6-8 or 12-8 meter.
I think that's not your beach read
Beach read. This is definitely not a beach read.
But that's not to say that it's not a worthy read. It's just to say that I think it requires of you a head that maybe isn't the one you're taking on your holiday.
Yeah, and if you don't like alliterative sentences with 8 metaphors separated by commas.
Yeah, beautifully done, mind you.
Beautifully done. Just perhaps, move on to something else for the meantime.
I don't think I wouldn't take it onto a beach. I think one thing that if you do read it, I think it's best reading it swiftly if you possibly can over the course of a few days, because otherwise I think it would be very easy just to kind of lose the thread of it. And it's a sort of an experience in reading it that I think has to happen quite intensely. It is poetic, isn't it? And it's, you know, really focused when you're reading it. You need to engage with it. You know, I read somewhere that it's very slow, particularly at the beginning, and I do think it is slow, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's slow, but it's not, I didn't find it laborious.
I guess it depends what you're expecting. We're back to the beach read here, aren't we?
So we've asked our followers on Twitter at Scottish BK Trust what they felt of Ghana Must Go, and we had this tweet from Miriam at Miriam Lander. She felt it was a brilliant book. She'd lived in Ghana as a child and felt that the characters, plot and pace were all excellent. Taye Selassie, in creating and interweaving all these different characters, voices and predicaments, doesn't lack ambition, but would you say she pulls it off? We have characters here from a 70-year-old carpenter meditating at 4 a.m. on a Ghanaian beach to a 19-year-old, arguably spoilt girl. Does she convince you of her characters through her writing, Taye Selassie?
That's a tricky one, because on one level, within the context of the novel, they're interesting characters and it's an interesting story. But on the other hand, there are things about the characters that are deeply frustrating, and you look at them and think, well, that's just unlikely. I mean, it's an unlikely family to many extents. The mother is breathtakingly beautiful and stops men in her tracks, and the twins are stunning and incredibly gifted.
World-renowned artists.
Exactly.
And also incredibly beautiful.
Indeed, and Olu is an incredible surgeon. And Sadie, for all her whatever, suddenly discovers the art of dance in the last few pages or whatever, you know. And
she things, can dance.
I know. And I think there was compromise there.
That's right. And Sadie's the great underachiever of the family, the 20-year-old at Yale who is the underachiever. I think Sadie actually was probably the character I relate to the most, in the sense of being the youngest member of the family and the one who feels like an outsider and the one who's observing her amazingly successful, beautiful siblings and mother from a sort of step removed. And also Sadie, I thought, was interesting because she's the character who knows the father the least well, because he departs from their lives when she's very, very young. So she's very sort of disconnected from that whole thread of the novel, in a way. She's sort of like the one person who isn't truly connected to the main plot line of the father dying, because she barely knew him. And I thought she was a good character, actually.
I mean, they're very heightened characters, but I think within the context of the novel itself, strangely they fit together within it, because it is a novel with, you know, exquisitely heightened language and structure and very crafted. It, when you start pulling them out of that context, it actually sounds quite strange who and what they are. But within the mix, there's something there that works together. I think it's a debut novel. I think towards the end, there is compromise there in terms of the characters. There is a need for resolution that maybe a more seasoned novelist wouldn't have bent to.
Yeah.
Would have left difficulty and argument and a lack of resolve, because that can be deeply fulfilling if you're reading it. Actually, you don't need to have everything tidied up.
I think there were things that frustrated me a little bit in the characterization, just because I didn't feel they were explained. So with Kwaku, the father, who I felt was really well-drawn character, as much as he was quite enigmatic and remote, obviously it's essential part of the storyline is that he leaves them all. And again, I thought that was partly convincing, but not wholly. I felt that there could have been more explanation around his reasons for that.
I think towards the end of the novel, I seem to be picking on the end of the novel, but there is the section at the end of the novel where the eldest son, Olu, goes back. We have this sort of revelation that he had gone back to meet with the father. Yeah. And I thought that had real potential to explain a lot and fill things in for the reader.
Do you think it did?
I don't think it did. No. I think it had the opportunity to weave together a lot, but it sort of, for me as a reader, missed the target there.
It did a bit. Yeah, because I felt that was a pivotal point when Olu went out, and that I was waiting for there to be, you know, at least some sort of confrontation, because their relationship was incredibly interesting, because Olu sort of was very like his father and very accepting of him. He kind of takes his father as he is. He's proud of him and defensive of him. And I thought that if there was going to be something revelatory that happened where the father expressed in more convincing reasons, his reasons for leaving his family, I thought it would probably come through that particular part. But actually it just ends with Olu getting upset and storming off.
And many things left unsaid. It is a novel where a huge amount is unsaid.
Like a family. Every Christmas.
Exactly. And then maybe that's a more realistic reflection, because only perhaps between the pages of novels do you get this full, detailed, you know, resolution and connection.
Yeah.
Whereas in life, everything, you know, 90% of what should be said never really gets said, because you're too busy talking nonsense half the time about other stuff as a distraction.
And this is a family, an African family, and an African-American family, first generation, second generation, trying to build a life in America. These aren't voices that we're necessarily used to seeing in fiction and used to seeing translated into 13 different languages or whatever it was at the last count. So the main theme of this book is undoubtedly identity, personal identity against a larger context of country. Do you feel that resonated with you as a reader from Northern Europe? It's a nice, easy question for you both.
I think it's a very good, actually, theme to have, because everyone connects with this in some way, because it's the sort of modern dilemma. Perhaps not that modern, in fact. You know, we're compelled to travel constantly because we can. The ability to travel, we do. We move for jobs between cities, countries, continents. And families are much more fragmented. You know, the idea of displacement occurs in families now as a sort of default, really, just because we're always pulled in different directions. So I think it is very much what is happening to all of us to some extent, that we are spreading further and further away from what we know and who we are. And I think it's very hard to, well, maybe not hard, but I think we form identity differently now. It's not about where you're from necessarily, but it's about where you're at that shapes you. What is in your surrounding that shaped you? What's in the past that shaped you? I think easy things like where are you from, and then someone saying, well, I'm from Edinburgh. And then that being a simple code that means something, I think those days are gone.
Because it's principally about family, that gives it a sort of something slightly universal, that it is something that many, many people can relate to. The question of identity, I think, is more to do with your identity within your family, how you relate to your siblings or the twins, for example, their deeply sort of close connection that they have and how the two of them together respond to the world. And there's this sort of idea of the way that families are divided up and how they can punish each other through their actions, and how, you know, family relationships and behaviours of individuals and families sort of grow out of each other. But I do have quite a big family, and, you know, like a lot of modern families, it's a little bit complicated, and people live in different places. As people, some people get on better with others, and you know, it's in this book, it's a complicated family, but it's a kind of typical family, and you know, people do live much further away from each other than they would.
But it's quite an exaggerated family to represent this concept of diaspora and spreading and identity, because this is a very mixed in the sense of Ghana, Nigeria background, American, and then one of them's off living in London and then New York. Yeah. It's very spread. It's sort of almost an exaggerated spread in order to, I think, to emphasize the point about, well, what is your identity? How do you form that? In which way does that get constructed?
And the identity of first generation immigrants as opposed to the second generation. So when Kweku is dying in his beautiful garden and the house that endlessly feeds into itself, almost like a emigrating and returning, his final words, I think, are born in dust, dead in grass, progress, distant shore reached. That was his aspiration, whereas his children seem to have more of a problem defining their identity, almost. They are the Afropolitans that Taye Selassie has been talking about. She talked about typing African boy into Google Images, and it just had boys with flies in their mouth suffering from malnutrition, child soldiers. And she said, this isn't the Africa I've experienced. The Africa I've experienced is aspirational, it's intelligent, it's dynamic. And I want to represent that in this book. The one thing that I'll take out of this book is the story of a new Africa emerging from this stereotype of the continent that we have in the West.
Maybe it's a perception of Africa that's prevailed in some ways through culture and through the media, but I think the point that she would be making is that it's an Africa that's always been there, and it's been her experience. And I think that's really an interesting point, actually, that it's very much outside of what you might kind of expect to read if you were going to read something about Ghana or Nigeria. It doesn't follow any of those stereotypes. You know, partly I think that is because they are very rich and they are a privileged family, and also because it's a very American novel as well.
But I think what will be interesting is the novels that come after this, actually, because I think as a seasoned writer, there will be very interesting things. This is clearly, I see this as being a novel driven by the author's personal experiences, because the parallels, her story, and again, debut novel, that seems to be a sensible leap to make, given what we know. So I think perhaps having exercised that, what comes next will be very interesting, to move beyond sort of setting out the stall, as it were, to see what depth and challenge she can bring to that. I think that will be the more interesting terrain.
Absolutely. It's an ambitious debut, and I think she does pull it off. And there is a lot to look forward to, I think, from Taye Selassie. Definitely. Sadly, like the sections of Selassie's book, We Must Be Gone, Get Going and Go. However, the conversation about Ghana Must Go doesn't need to end here. If you've read the book, please add your thoughts to our podcast page in the reading section of ScottishBookTrust.com, tweet us your thoughts in 140 characters at ScottishBKTrust, or seek out our podcast post on Facebook. Don't forget to tune into the pod in 2 weeks' time for author interviews and exciting book talk with Ryan Van Winkle, and in a month's time for our discussion of The Quarry by the late, great Ian Banks. All that's left to say is to say thanks to our guest, Will Mackey, and special thanks to Ali Bowden from Edinburgh City of Lit. Follow them at Edin City of Lit on Twitter. And of course, thanks to you, the listener. Goodbye and happy reading.
Book Talk is produced by Colin Fraser, music by Sam Gallagher.